just in preamble, we are now towards the middle of February, and yesterday was, you know, traditionally speaking, the day of Saraswati. So it's something, and Mother's birthday is coming up in a week's time. So it's a very special confluence of Shakti at this time, and would be nice to keep in attention or keep in our minds receptivity to a special energy that is present now. We were on chapter 4 in book 2, part 1, and it's a chapter called The Divine and the Undivine. The passage I have is, but these conditions are only reasonings or primary intuitions. And the page number would be, can somebody give me the page number in the...
412 in the PDF. It starts with, but these conclusions are the first two.
Okay. 412?
Yes, in the PDF.
Okay. Good. So, Sri Aurobindo is dealing in this chapter with the one of the primary issues that faces us in the world, which has led to many different stances that humanity has taken in its thinking as well as in its understanding of how to conduct life, which has to do with our sense of the imperfection of life, the sense of suffering as well as of evil, of cruelty and of wanton pleasure in perversity that we find in the world. And he has discussed this so far. It is one of the primary reasons for denying the existence of God, because our basic intuition of goodness is violated at every stage in our lives by the unjust and by the unfortunate and unhappy circumstances of life. So we try to make sense of this. The most simple-minded sense we can make of it is to think of ourselves as leading an existence which is unfortunate because we happen to possess the faculty of a sense of good and evil. We have consciousness which demands consciousness but meets only unconsciousness around us. And we find that unconsciousness within us as well if we study our own behaviors. And we find that we are helpless to a large extent in front of this unconsciousness, not only as recipients, but as doers in this world, as people who act in this world. So Sri Aurobindo is dealing with this problem, and he has already raised a number of the issues that pertain to this experience, and he has also by this point pretty much given us a clear idea of how we are to deal with this from the depth of our own human intuition. And that idea pertains to the fact that there is some kind of a perfection in divine perfection that we are aware of, something that we are conscious of. But at the same time, our dissatisfaction with conditions is itself an index of the fact that there is something in us that participates in moving things towards that perfect ideal. So he points out that there is a divinity, and that divinity is present in unfolding things in the cosmos, in nature, but sort of as a function of time, imperfection exists, and we not only experience it, but aspire to go beyond it. And that also is divine. And so I'd like to read a couple of small passages which were very potent in the previous paragraphs. A couple of paragraphs before, he says, but there is an essential factor in our human consciousness and its workings, which no less than the reason distinguishes it entirely from the animal. So because this is seems to be a perception and a dissatisfaction which we have as human beings, which we don't see to that extent in animals or in any other of living things or non-living things in the cosmos. And clearly it is due to the awakening of something in us which gives us dissatisfaction. He has touched on this very early in The Life Divine, where he makes that out into almost the special quality of being human, and a godlike quality which is not even given to the divine, I mean the gods, as it were, the deities, and certainly not to animals. So here he says, it distinguishes it entirely from the animal. There is not only a mental part in us which recognizes the imperfection, there is a psychic part which rejects it. So here are both these in the human, which is not there in animals, let's say. In gods, there may be the mental part, but there isn't that psychic part. Our soul's dissatisfaction with imperfection as a law of life upon earth, its aspiration towards the elimination of all imperfections from our nature, not only in a heaven beyond where it would be automatically impossible to be imperfect, but here and now in a life where perfection has to be conquered by evolution and struggle, are as much a law of our being as that against which they revolt. So this is one of the high points of Sri Aurobindo's philosophy. It's this idea that this issue that is brought up in philosophy, that God made a world, and since God is good, then the world must also be good and must be perfect. If it's not perfect, then we're wrong to some extent. Either we did something wrong which brought us some kind of misfortune, which is the original sin idea, or we are imperfect by constitution somehow, so that though the world is perfect, we don't perceive it as perfect, and we should do something to ourselves so that we accept it as perfect. So there is the tacit understanding that there is a perfection already present here. All the natural files, the people who urge us to stay natural, to stay within nature and not proceed anywhere outside of nature, because nature indeed is given to us by the divine, and it is divine. That notion of the perfection of nature and as something which we have to accept because it is divine, he affirms it on the one hand and posits another kind of perfection beside it on the other. And he says that too is equally divine. And that is that this world, that the intuition of a sort of imperfection that we have is also divine. And it is that which moves us to conquer itself by evolution and struggle. as much a law of our being as that against which they revolt. They too are divine, a divine dissatisfaction, a divine aspiration. In them is the inherent light of a power within, which maintains them in us, so that the divine may not only be there as a hidden reality in our spiritual secrecies, but unfold itself in the evolution of nature. So he pretty much gives us the, you know, gist, the innermost diamond of understanding this knotty problem in these lines itself. And then in the next paragraph, he ends in a similar manner. He says, where to the argument that we have to accept the conditions of the cosmos as the God-given conditions, you know, which is what the Buddha did in asserting that the fundamental, you know, strain of reality was suffering. But then he went on to say that we have to get out of the suffering by essentially negating the phenomenal experience. So here he says, it is right and reasonable to endure with equanimity suffering and subjection to defect as the immediate will of God, a present law of imperfection laid on our members, but on condition that we recognize it also as the will of God in us to transcend evil and suffering, to transform imperfection into perfection, to rise into a higher law of divine nature. In our human consciousness, there is the image of an ideal truth of being, a divine nature, an incipient Godhead. This is part of our innermost intuition. And that's what brings us this problem of the undivine, as he calls it, and makes us grapple with it, struggle with it. In relation to that higher truth, our present state of imperfection can be relatively described as an undivine life, and the conditions of the world from which we start as undivine conditions. The imperfections are the indication given to us that they are there as first disguises, not as the intended expression of the divine being and the divine nature. It is a power within us, the concealed divinity, that has lit the flame of aspiration, pictures the image of the ideal, keeps alive our discontent, and pushes us to throw off the disguise or reveal, or in the Vedic phrase, to form and disclose the Godhead in the manifest spirit, mind, life, and body of this terrestrial creature. Our present nature can only be transitional, our imperfect status a starting point and opportunity for the achievement of another higher, wider, and greater that shall be divine and perfect, not only by the secret spirit within it, but in its manifest and most outward form of existence. So, Sri Aurobindo puts his finger on how we are to conduct ourselves. And one may use the term spiritual revolutionary for this kind of, orientation that Sri Aurobindo brings. This is, one may say, even a kind of carryover or continuation of his earlier revolutionary past, moving out of politics but entering into life itself as the field of its revolution. But he goes further, and where we are right now, he moves from this probing of the human intuition to a more cosmological argument. And it is essentially the same idea, but now he wants to find out and investigate, examine what are the cosmic factors that has led to this situation. Why is it that this is our experience? So this is what he will now deal with. As we know, he has also touched on the enormous confusion that has arisen due to this experience, the various kinds of philosophies that we've spawned from our cosmologies that we've spawned, on the one hand, from a certain dualism. The dualism can have many different guises. One guise is a kind of radical duality of struggle between good and evil. Okay? That is to be found even in the Vedic corpus. But in the Vedic corpus, of course, that coexists with the notion of the one, a transcendental one. We find that very prominently in Zoroastrianism, or in some Zoroastrian-derived philosophies like Manichaeism, which is much more primarily dualistic and binary in its seeing of the good and evil that will never, in a sense, depart. And human life is made to struggle against evil, but you know, also as in the Greek ideal or myth of Sisyphus, something which we can never overcome, yet are doomed to struggle for all our lives. There is a certain truth to this, and we can consider that later, and Sri Aurobindo also deals with this truth in Savitri, particularly in the canto on the soul forces, the triple soul forces. The other side of it asserts that there is always a divine, and that the divine perfection, as we said, is already here. This too has two sides to it. One which says that there is a transcendent divine, but the conditions of the cosmos are imperfect due to some kind of maybe laissez-faire attitude of that transcendent divine that does not take part in this creation, or that this creation is some kind of a disordered possibility among the infinite possibilities of the divine, and once in a while that divine listens or hears the prayers of its suffering entities and intervenes with grace. But it is a sporadic thing. The grace is not something which changes anything except for temporary conditions for a person or two or a few people. Or else there is another idea, which is, so if we take that as the idea, then the natural answer to how we should conduct ourselves would be, let's get out of here, out of this sphere of avidya, which is a permanent condition of the undivine. And then finally, there may be an attitude which says that the divine is present, it is perfect, and it is also here. And if we don't experience it as such, it is because of some problem within us, as he pointed out earlier. So we need to correct ourselves, but first we need to accept things as they are, as perfect. Sri Aurobindo is saying there is a partial truth to that. And so all these may have some grain of truth, but it is not the entire truth. And as we saw earlier, the way to conduct our lives is to accept our present condition to be immediately perfect. In other words, given the condition of a struggling and evolving ignorance, as one of the self-definitions of the divine itself, we have to accept the play of forces as the condition under which the divine is manifest in the cosmos at the present, and yet we have to aspire to arrive at a better condition and try to find the force or power within. In this sense, it is true, as Nietzsche says, that power is the primary, you know, property in the cosmos. It is by power that the cosmos evolves to a better condition through the struggle of the ignorance. I think with that, if there are any questions or comments, we can discuss it and otherwise continue with that paragraph.
Joanna, would you like to start reading?
But these conclusions are only first reasonings or primary intuitions founded on our inner self experience and the apparent facts of universal existence. They cannot be entirely validated unless we know the real cause of ignorance, imperfection, and suffering and their place in the cosmic purpose or cosmic order. There are three propositions about God and the world, if we admit the divine existence, to which the general reason and consciousness of mankind bear witness. But one of the three, which is yet necessitated by the character of the world we live in, does not harmonize with the two others. And by this disharmony, the human mind is thrown into great perplexities of contradiction and driven to doubt and denial. For, first, we find affirmed an omnipotent divinity, an omnipresent divinity and reality, pure, perfect, and blissful, without whom, apart from whom, nothing could exist, since all exists only by him and in his being. All thinking on this subject that is not aesthetic or materialistic or else primitive and anthropomorphic has to start from this admission or to arrive at this fundamental concept. It is true that certain religions seem to suppose an extra cosmic deity who has created a world outside and apart from his own existence, but when they come to construct a theology or spiritual philosophy, these two admit omnipresence or immanence, for this omnipresence imposes itself, is a necessity of spiritual thinking. If there is such a divinity, self, or reality, it must be everywhere, one and indivisible. Nothing can possibly exist apart from its existence. Nothing can be born from another than that. There can be nothing unsupported by that, independent of it, unfulfilled by the breath and power of its being. It has been held, indeed, that the ignorance, the imperfection, the suffering of this world are not supported by the divine existence. But we have then to suppose two gods, an Ormuzd of the good and an Ahriman of the evil, or perhaps a perfect supercosmic and immanent being, and an imperfect cosmic demiurge or separate undivine nature. This is a possible conception, but improbable to our highest intelligence. It can only be at most a subordinate aspect, not the original truth or the whole truth of things. Nor can we suppose that the one self and spirit in all and the one power creator of all are different, contrary in the character of their being, separate in their will and purpose. Our reason tells us, our intuitive consciousness feels, and their witness is confirmed by spiritual experience, that the one pure and absolute existence exists in all things and beings, even as all things and beings exist in it and by it, and nothing can be or happen without this indwelling and all-supporting presence.
So I'd like to draw attention, actually, there was one sentence misread, which was an important one. And that was the one where he's saying for first we find affirmed an omnipresent divinity and reality, pure, perfect, and blissful, without whom, apart from whom, nothing could exist, since all exists only by him and in his being. All thinking on the subject that is not atheistic or materialistic, that was read as aesthetic. I think the idea, as I pointed out earlier, is that we could, of course, in a sense, the most natural thing is to deny the existence of God, that only matter exists, or there is no sense of good and evil. It is an amoral universe in which we seem to have developed a kind of artificial sense of good and evil due to some peculiar property of being human, which is not present as such in the universe. This could be one way of understanding our predicament, and it would immediately drive us to deny the existence of this one being that he's talking about and become an atheist. And that accounts for a large amount of the atheism that is there in the world. It's interesting that this particular paragraph, again, is one in which Sri Aurobindo draws strongly or invokes strongly our highest intelligence, as he says, and it's something like a highest intuition. And this is not necessarily available to everybody. It already recognizes or implies that a certain amount of internal purification has occurred, so that this intuition is affirmed in our consciousness. We seem to feel that there must be a single, this is the primary foundation of the Upanishads, Vedantic thinking. This is why Sri Aurobindo's Life Divine is a contemporary Vedantic text. Because it is standing on this foundation, the first one that he's talking about over here. And it clearly is a powerful intuition, which one can sense behind the facade of this world due to a variety of factors, partly the, sense of reason, the sense of a certain system, a systematic deployment of energies that we see all around us, but also due to various kinds of internal mechanisms of unity that ultimately affirm the existence of the One rather than deny it. So this is one intuition, an overriding intuition. There's also the intuition of transcendence in philosophies like transcendental empiricism, where there is an intuition of the being of difference, if we might call it that, the same being who is self-manifest as infinite, different, never repeated realities. So that is the first intuition that he's talking about, the first almost a principle or proposition about God and the world. What is the relationship between God and the world? Assuming that there is such a thing and, taking that assumption from what he calls our highest intelligence and our deepest intuition of reality.
Kikha, would you like to read?
Sure. A second affirmation, which our mind naturally accepts as the consequence of the first postulate, is that by the supreme consciousness and the supreme power of this omnipresent divinity, in its perfect universal knowledge and divine wisdom, all things are ordered and governed in their fundamental relations and their process. But on the other hand, the actual process of things, the actual relations which we see are as presented to our human consciousness, relations of imperfection, of limitation. There appears a disharmony, even a perversion, something that is the contrary of our conception of the divine existence. A very apparent denial, or at least a disfigurement or disguise of the divine presence. There arises then a third affirmation of the divine reality and the world reality as different in essence or in order. So different that we have to draw away from one to reach the other. If we would find the divine inhabitant, we must reject the world he inhabits, governs, has created or manifested in his own existence. The first of these three propositions is inevitable. The second also must stand if the omnipresent divine has anything at all to do with the world he inhabits and with its manifestation, building, maintenance and government. But the third seems also self-evident, and yet it is incompatible with its precedence. And this dissonance confronts us with a problem which appears to be incapable of satisfactory solution.
So here Sri Aurobindo presents us with the two other propositions, and we can see how he is proceeding, because instead of just rejecting with a single proposition the possibility of the existence of God because there is imperfection or the undivine in the cosmos, he puts side by side three propositions relating God and the cosmos, which start with the assumption, or with not just the mental assumption, but a perceived assumption arising out of our intuitions that out of some perfect condition, this has emerged. And that perfect condition is pervasive within it, so that there is a divinity present in the cosmos. So as I said, the first proposition is like the ultimate foundation of Vedantic thinking, and it is also an intuition that is naturally present in human beings, were they to quiet themselves sufficiently to be considerate of the enormous unity of things. The second one pertains actually to two of the other Western conditions of divinity. If the first is omnipresence, the second one is a combination of omnipotence and omniscience. And that is because there is a single power, according to that, as he puts it over here, a knowledge and wisdom which is perfectly manifesting in the world. So everything is ordered and governed in their fundamental relations and their processes. So it seems to be that there is a immanent divine, just as the first asserts a transcendent divine, the second is asserting an immanent divine, a divine that is within the cosmos in all its movements. It is present in every movement of the cosmos. And it also is an intelligence which is perfectly working out according to a single scheme the unfolding processes of the cosmos. Now, both these can be very objective ways of looking at things, or propositions even. We can look at the cosmos and assert, or propose at least, that there is a certain pervasive unity and there is a certain logic and perfection to the unfolding of nature. But there is a third glaring proposition which has to be accepted, otherwise we are left in some kind of a incomplete, erroneous, rose-tinted world, which does not really pertain to our empirical experience. So we have the transcendent, we have the immanent, and we have the empirical. The empirical is what meets us, what rubs us in our everyday experience. And that is what he says over here, the third affirmation of the divine reality and the world reality as different in essence or in order. So these are two different things. It's again a return to the dualism. It is as if God and the world are incompatible. What actually we experience in the world is not a certain kind of affirmation in experience. It may be some kind of affirmation in intuition or some sort of hidden virtuality of the world that gives us some sort of impression of an unfoldment that has laws to it, that is divinely governed and ordered. But in our experience, it's so far from the truth. There is so much unhappiness, suffering, and disfigurement of any particular perfection that we have either to reject the world to experience that perfection, which has been the stance of all the so-called Mayavadi philosophies, or even of the otherworldly heaven outside of the world philosophies, as in all the Abrahamic traditions, or we have to become atheists and materialists, not only to make sense of this imperfect world, but to exercise our aspiration to perfect it. You know, we would rather deny God and build whatever our reason tells us is a better world than accept the premise that there is some kind of God present in this cosmos that is either impotent or that is cruel. He keeps coming back to these two insufficiencies of the argument that God is in control of everything. If God was in control of everything, how come he has little understanding of our experience? Unless he was either cruel or he didn't have power enough. So this is where Sri Aurobindo, you know, puts side by side these three propositions and, you know, kind of tests their resonance, one may say, to arrive at some kind of a universal cosmic understanding of where we stand with regard to this problem of the divine and the undivine.
Margaret, would you like to read next?
Okay. It is not difficult by some construction of the philosophic reason or of theological reasoning to circumvent the difficulty. It is possible to erect a feignant deity like the gods of Epicurus, blissful in himself, observing but indifferent to a world conducted or misconducted by a mechanical law of nature. It is open to us to posit a witness self, a silent soul in things, a Purusha who allows nature to do what she will and is content to reflect all her order and all her disorders in his passive and stainless consciousness, or a supreme self absolute, inactive, free from all relations, unconcerned with the works of the cosmic illusion or creation, which has mysteriously or paradoxically originated from it or over against it to tempt and afflict a world of temporal creatures. But all these solutions do more than reflect the apparent dissonance of our twofold experience. They do not attempt to reconcile, neither do they solve or explain it, but only affirm it by an open or covert dualism and an essential division of the indivisible. Practically, there is affirmed a dual Godhead, self or soul and nature. But nature, the power in things, cannot be anything else than a power of the self, the soul, the essential being of things. Her works cannot be altogether independent of soul or self, cannot be her own contrary result and working unaffected by its consent or refusal or a violence of mechanical force imposed on an inertia of mechanical passivity. It is possible again to posit an observing inactive self and an active creating Godhead. But this device cannot serve us, for in the end, these two must really be one in a dual aspect. The Godhead, the active aspect of the observing self, the self a witness of its own Godhead in action. A discord, a gulf between the self in knowledge and the same self in its works, needs explanation, but it presents itself as unexplained and inexplicable. Or again, we can posit a double consciousness of Brahman, the reality, one static and one dynamic, one essential and spiritual, in which it is self, perfect and absolute, another formative, pragmatic, in which it becomes not self, and with which its absoluteness and perfection have no concern of participation. For it is only a temporal formation in the timeless reality. But to us, who even if only half existent, half conscious, yet inhabit the absolute's half dream of living and are compelled by nature to have in it a terrible and insistent concern and to deal with it as real, this wears the appearance of an obvious mystification. For this temporal consciousness and its formations are also in the end a power of the oneself. Depend upon it, can exist only by it. What exists by the power of the reality cannot be unrelated to it, or that unrelated to the world of its own powers making. If the world exists by the Supreme Spirit, so also its ordering and relations must exist by the power of the Spirit Its law must be according to some law of the spiritual consciousness and existence. The self, the reality, must be aware of and aware in the world consciousness which exists in its being. A power of the self, the reality, must be constantly determining or at least sanctioning its phenomena and operations. For there can be no independent power, no nature not derived from the original and eternal self-existence. If it does no more, it must still be originating or determining the universe through the mere fact of its conscious omnipresence. It is no doubt the truth of spiritual experience that there is a status of peace and silence in the infinite behind the cosmic activity, a consciousness that is the immobile witness of the creation. But this is not the whole of spiritual experience, and we cannot hope to find in one side only of knowledge a fundamental and total explanation of the universe.
So here he brings up a number of either overt or covert dualities through which our philosophies have tried in the past to answer this question. And most of them have to do with either the existence, I mean, he's even assuming in most of these cases the existence of a God, but this divine has no truck with nature or with the cosmos. Either the divine is asleep or the divine is disinterested and witnessing only, or allowing some part of its executive faculty to enter into a meaningless kind of mishmash or chaos, which is the experience of the people in that cosmos. So this first proposition, or this first idea that he, posits as a construction of the philosophic reason or theological reasoning, has to do with the Greek Epicurean idea. And phania deity is a kind of a idol god, a god who doesn't do anything. It just exists but has no action in the world. And of course here there is an implicit understanding that there is a creator and a creation, so that the creator is separate from the creation. That is already a duality. And that creator is idle by its non-action in the creation. And what would be our attitude there? Our attitude there would be the Epicurean attitude, which is supposed to be we make the best of our human condition by enjoying the world, but enjoying it in moderation. Because enjoying it in excess, nobody's going to help us. We will suffer, and the suffering comes to us without any redeeming grace of any divine power that can show us that we need to be moderate, or that we need to strive for unity or whatever. So just by our human effort, we have to learn to enjoy in moderation. Of course, in later times, the idea of Epicureanism became conflated with hedonism. In other words, it was an excessive enjoyment principle that characterized Epicureans, with the notion that there is no God and we can do whatever we want. So it was in a sense like a lokayata philosophy of the Indians, a materialistic and at the same time hedonistic philosophies. There is no tomorrow, so let's enjoy to the best what we can today. But what he's talking about here is more the earlier Epicureanism, which affirms that there is a God and that we should lead moderate lives for having enjoyment in the world, but there is no action of God upon the world. Otherwise, he moves to the Indian Mayavada philosophies, which are like a covert dualism, as he says over there, that there is a Purusha who is a witness self but allows nature to do what she will and is content to reflect all her order and all her disorders in his passive and stainless consciousness. So here there is some cosmic illusion, as he says, or creation that has mysteriously or paradoxically originated from that reality. This may be something, as I said, which is allowed to act out certain forms of randomness, disorder. But the point he is making is that nevertheless, if we are to take it even as that, the cosmos that manifests as a result has consciousness within it, and the beings of that conscious of that cosmos are conscious beings, and that consciousness is something that is hugely violated in an experience of this kind, and hence it is justified in supposing that whatever gave reality to this condition must not be good. It cannot be our definition of God. It cannot satisfy our highest definition of God. It's also interesting that that kind of argument that Sri Aurobindo is drawing on, you know, to some extent, of course, if we go back to the Vedas and the Upanishads, we find arguments of that kind. God is called Shiva. Shiva means the auspicious one, the good one, the primary intuition, the Platonic intuition of the three primary ideas of beauty, good, and truth at the very heights of in reality, which is the intuition of the divine, is also affirmed, you know, in Satyam, Shivam, Sundaram, the Vedic formula, which is exactly, in a sense, that, the truth, the good, and the beautiful. So we find that this argument, however, gets lost in India over time. There does not seem to be the need to affirm the fact that if God is good, then his cosmos must be good. It is ultimately taken that this God who is good is has nothing to do with the cosmos, or has only a kind of a hidden presence that can be invoked but cannot really change or transform the conditions of its opposite here in the world. So this is the duality that he feels or stages in this particular paragraph. And he looks at it from a variety of directions, and he eventually even looks at these as two kinds or two actions of the same being, of Brahman, one passive and one active. And in fact, Sri Aurobindo will use these terms, the passive Brahman and the active Brahman, to describe his own experience of the ways in which this one consciousness appears in the cosmos. There does seem to be a duality between a part of this being that is a pure witness and the part that is active in the world. But the two cannot be two different ideas or principles. They cannot have a complete disjunction between them. It has to be the same in two statuses rather than two realities or two ontologies of opposition. So he ends that paragraph by pointing out, he refuses to accept dualities of that kind, whether overt or covert, and that if there is an action of nature, that action of nature must be fully known by the presence and power of the spirit. It cannot be that if that spirit is good, that he allows evil to exist in the world, separate from itself, as having characteristics which are its opposite.
Dan Wood, would you like to read next? Oh, he says his mic is not working. Daniel Harris?
Where are we at? I just cut off the road I was driving.
We are on page 416, the paragraph starting once we admit.
Okay, got it. Once we admit a divine government of the universe, we must conclude that the power to govern is complete and absolute. For otherwise, we are obligated to suppose that a being and consciousness, infinite and absolute, has a knowledge and will limit it in their control of things or hampered in their power of working. It is not impossible to concede that the supreme and immanent divinity may leave as a certain freedom of working to something that has come into being in his perfection, but is itself imperfect and the cause of imperfection. To an ignorant or inconsistent nature, to the action of the human mind, and well, even to a consciousness power, to a conscious power or forces of darkness and evil that take their stand upon the reign of a basic inconscience. But none of these things are independent of its own existence, nature, and consciousness, and none of them can act except in its presence by its sanction or allowance. Man's freedom is relative, and he cannot be held solely responsible for the imperfection of his nature. Ignorance and inconscience of nature have arisen, not independently, but in the one being. The imperfection of her workings cannot be entirely foreign to some will of the immanence. It may be conceded that forces set in motion are allowed to work themselves out according to the law of their movement. But what divine omniscience and omnipotence has allowed to arise and act in its omnipresence? It's all existence. We must consider it to have originated and decreed, since without that fiat of the being, they could not remain in existence. If the divine is at all concerned with the world, he has manifested, there is no other Lord than he, and from that necessity of his original and universal being, there can eventually be no escape or departure. It is on the foundation of his self-evident consequence of our first premise, without any evasion of its implications, that we have to consider the problem of imperfection, suffering, and evil.
So, he continues the idea or the thought over here, the refusal to go for half solutions or dualisms, and affirms the possibility that in consciousness, the creatures may be experiencing a certain kind of free will, and that that also is something which may be allowed by that one conscious being, but it cannot be outside of the knowledge of that one conscious being. So that to assert that things are imperfect here because we are imperfect, that there has been seeded some kind of a, you know, firstly, there is the machinic quality of life, that we are to a large extent driven by machinery. But also that we have something, some will, which is given its freedom, but which is ignorant. And due to that existence of an ignorant conscious will in the creatures, there is the experience of suffering. But Sri Aurobindo is trying to get a cosmological grip on this problem here. And so an individual subjective imperfection also cannot be but outside of the designs and knowledge of the one pervading and omnipotent, omniscient being, if indeed such is the case. So we have to assume that there will be just that one, and whatever we are experiencing is not without the consent and the origin of that one.
I can go next. And first, we must realize that the existence of ignorance, error, limitation, suffering, division, and discord in the world need not by itself, as we too hastily imagine, be a denial or a disproof of the divine being, consciousness, power, knowledge, will, delight in the universe. They can be that if we have to take them by themselves separately, but need not be so taken if we get a clear vision of their place and significance in a complete view of the universal workings. A part broken off from the whole may be imperfect, ugly, incomprehensible, but when we see it in the whole, it recovers its place in the harmony. It has a meaning and a use. The divine reality is infinite in its being. In this infinite being, we find limited being everywhere. That is the apparent fact from which our existence here seems to start, and to which our own narrow ego and its egocentric activities bear constant witness. But in reality, when we come to an integral self-knowledge, we find that we are not limited, for we also are infinite. Our ego is only a face of the universal being and has no separate existence. Our apparent separative individuality is only a surface movement, and behind it, our real individuality stretches out to unity with all things and upward to oneness with the transcendent divine infinity. Thus, our ego, which seems to be a limitation of existence, is really a power of infinity. The boundless multiplicity of beings in the world is a result and signal evidence, not of limitation or finiteness, but of that illimitable infinity. Apparent division can never erect itself into a real separateness. There is supporting and overriding it an indivisible unity which division itself cannot divide. This fundamental world fact of ego and apparent division and their separative workings in the world existence is no denial of the divine nature of unity and indivisible being. They are the surface results of an infinite multiplicity which is a power of the infinite oneness.
So this is here, from this paragraph, Sri Aurobindo starts giving us his answer to this conundrum. And he starts by talking about almost a kind of a gestalt understanding of the relation between the part and the whole, that we can be lost in the experience of the part and separate it, extract it from its relations with the whole. And when we do that, we find both in our perception as well as in our action a certain kind of disjuncture between the individuals and the cosmos. So that is what gives us a certain sense of the imperfection of things, because it is a jostling of infinite independent wills that causes this kind of sort of friction and this inability to experience the oneness of things. And hence, we may say that from a certain point of view, it is a experience of the partial. And he points out that this experience is not also the intrinsic experience of the partial, but the surface experience of the partial, an apparent experience that is produced due to a centration of consciousness. Consciousness centers itself in each of these surfaces as independent entities that know themselves as limited and separate. And that is their ego experience. That's why that last line, he so beautifully and succinctly sums it up by saying that the fundamental world fact of ego and apparent division and their separative workings in the world existence is no denial of the divine nature of unity and indivisible being. They are the surface results of an infinite multiplicity, which is a power of the infinite oneness. So, for the one, there is no division. It is indivisible, yet it is protean, and so it has infinite capacity and can look at itself in infinite ways. And this infinite multiplicity that results from that kind of deployment of its protean power is also something which is full or replete with its oneness. But it can also create surface impressions that make it seem as if this oneness is denied, because each entity has its separate reality, a reality which can be shut off from the rest. So this is the beginning of the answer. Even that leaves a lot of questions unanswered. And he is going to proceed to work towards resolving these questions. I may draw our attention to an earlier chapter, the Brahman Purusha Ishvara chapter, where Sri Aurobindo talks about the action of the divine in the cosmos as proceeding through three principles, three dynamic principles. The principle of self-limitation, the principle of self-variation, and the principle of self-prospection. The principle of self-limitation causes a cosmos to emerge that is graded in terms of consciousness. The consciousness is fully expressed at one end and limited in a graded form, so that there are certain properties that become manifest and other properties that go to the background, that become almost latent or unavailable. Yet, the entirety of the divine is present even in this self-limitation. So this is as far as the graded appearance of the cosmos is concerned. Now, we are talking about these things as if they are spatial entities. We are talking about them as eternal entities that can be mapped in some sort of space in which there is a gradation of consciousness. But this self-limitation process is also a temporal process that lends itself to an unfolding or an evolution. On the second principle, we have variation, self-variation. In other words, even within the self-limitation or outside of it, the infinity of possibilities of this one being can manifest themselves as variations of a single theme, as it were. So if there is a self-limitation into a certain range of properties of existence and power, this range will also vary itself through innumerable infinity, an infinite, spectrum or an infinite mapping of variants, of variations. And the third is self-prospection, which means that into each of these self-limited and self-varied possibilities, the entirety of this one being takes its station, enters into it. The immanence within not just a principle, but immanent within a entity. Every entity, every instance of the whole is the third property. Now, the entity, however, has an experience which includes a fourth kind of property, and that is the property of separateness. And that is brought about by one of these ranges of consciousness. That is the entire segment known as avidya. So avidya or ignorance, ultimately residing in mind, or as Sri Aurobindo calls it, overmind, what he uses using Upanishadic terminology or including Upanishadic terminology, the overmind maya, is what allows independent, separative consciousnesses to exist, and these separative consciousnesses to lose their sense of the one that is present in them all, which has drawn a veil upon itself. So this is one of the primary conditions that allows this state of imperfection and the undivine to be experienced. But it is also a condition that is both spatially and temporally limited. It is limited in terms of a self-manifestation that is varying itself over time as well as over space. And that is partly the reason why the separative superficial experience of the ego cannot come to full understanding of this reality.
John Robert, would you like to read next?
Happy to. There is then no real division or limitation of being, no fundamental contradiction of the omnipresent reality. But there does seem to be a real limitation of consciousness. There is an ignorance of self, a veiling of the inner divinity, and all perfection is it, and all imperfection is its consequence. For we identify ourselves mentally, vitally, physically with this superficial ego consciousness, which is our first insistent self-experience. This does impose on us not a fundamentally real, but a practical division with all the untoward consequences of that separateness from the reality. But here again, we have to discover that from the point of view of God's workings, whatever be our reactions or our experience on the surface, this fact of ignorance is itself an operation of knowledge and not a true ignorance. Its phenomenon of ignorance is a superficial movement, for behind it is an indivisible all-consciousness. Ignorance is a frontal power of that all consciousness, which limits itself in a certain field, within certain boundaries, to a particular operation of knowledge, a particular mode of conscious working, and keeps back all the rest of its knowledge in waiting as a force behind it. All that is thus hidden is an occult store of light and power for the all consciousness to draw upon for the evolution of our being and nature. There is a secret working which fills up all the deficiencies of the frontal ignorance, acts through its apparent stumblings, prevents them from leading to another final result than that which the all-knowledge has decreed, helps the soul in the ignorance to draw from its experience, even from the natural personality's sufferings and errors, what is necessary for its evolution, and to leave behind what is no longer utilizable. This frontal power of ignorance is a power of concentration in a limited working, much like that power in our human mentality by which we absorb ourselves in a particular object and in a particular work and seem to use only so much knowledge, only such ideas as are necessary for it. The rest, which are alien to it or would interfere with it, are put back for the moment. Yet in reality, all the time, it is the indivisible consciousness which we are that has done the work to be done, seeing the thing that has to be seen. That, and not any fragment of consciousness or any exclusive ignorance in us, is the silent knower and worker. So is it too with this frontal power of concentration of the all consciousness within us.
So this paragraph is in fact very similar to one of those paragraphs from that chapter I mentioned, Brahman Purusha Ishvara chapter, where he's talking about these principles of the action of consciousness in the cosmos. And he's talking about the power of self-limitation as a kind of power of concentration. Because indeed, what is allowing a self-limited consciousness to become operational is exactly such a power of concentration in a certain narrow range of properties, putting the rest of it behind so as to explore the powers and variations of those properties. So, and Sri Aurobindo draws a comparison between that and our own action, which is really a subsidiary action of the same kind, because indeed it is the same power, a shakti, that is acting both in the cosmos and in the individual. And so its operations are very similar, or the same, identical, by which it brings to the front a certain conglomeration of understandings and forces and deploys these in a concentrated manner while keeping the rest of our experiences behind the surface. So too with, in a much more, you know, we may say in a much more profound way and much more, you know, kind of cosmic way, this process is being carried out by world nature, or Brahman in the world, or the active Brahman, as he's called it elsewhere. So we find that there is a certain kind of access to the rest of the reality behind the surface, but it is as if by an active pressure from within that a kind of stratification of being takes place in every self-limited range through which some properties are pushed to the front and into active, movement, while the rest are kept passive and latent in the back. In our experience, we find that if we are to assume that the entirety of the divine is stored in our background consciousness, both in an individual and personal way, through our journey through time as evolving entities, and in an impersonal way as the cosmic vastness that has us as its front, yet we find that we do not have that much access to those hidden depths. What Sri Aurobindo is saying over here is that nevertheless, it is an intelligence from those hidden depths that is keeping watch and that does intervene whenever necessary to see that the decreed result is carried out. This implies that whatever it is that is deployed on the surface is acting instinctively, is acting as, in a way, Plato also said, through memory, through a memory of its origin, rather than through the direct action of its origin. This is what causes the kind of insufficiency that our ignorance brings into our experience. Nevertheless, behind it, there is this saving power that is choosing, as it were, on a real-time basis, the kind of circumstantial and willing processes that we experience in our lives. This sense of, self-limitation is also a concentration. This is a very important point that he's making. So it is really a tapas, what may be called chit tapas, the concentrated force of consciousness that is giving the appearance of things and at the same time positing a certain surface freedom so that whatever is given a certain kind of appearance takes that appearance to be its reality. This is why in the Upanishads they will say we are made or we are fashioned with our senses turned outwards. It isn't that that is the only way things can be, but whatever it is that is allowing this kind of unfoldment, evolutionary unfoldment to occur, is keeping things in a certain type of ignorance so that they may grow in self-knowledge as well as in the freedom of their own wills. So that surface consciousness and the ego experience of separation also has its utility, but its utility is really to awaken its aspiration so that it may turn those same senses within, so that it may challenge the grooves of nature, as it were, recognizing what is happening, but also striving to remove the veil by its own processes of accessing those hidden depths that are denied to it. And it is in that process that we gradually move towards a more perfect deployment of the very same forces that have made us what we are.
Devashish, when Sri Aurobindo is talking about this philosophically, it still feels like he's also giving personal suggestions of sadhana, or that it affects the personal spiritual growth. Is it he's doing both at the same time?
Yeah, undoubtedly. I believe exactly that. So these passages are giving us a certain view, they are explaining to us and giving us a certain view of the operations of consciousness in the cosmos and in the individual. And with that understanding, this is the whole notion of Jnana Yoga, which is that deep intuitions give us a certain kind of truth viewing, we may say, revelation. And that allows us to orient ourselves and to proceed to find that which we need to, you know, uncover. And so I completely agree that it is both a explanation as well as an orientation, an effort to put us in yoga. It is both darshan and yoga in that sense.
Thank you.
I find it a lot harder to read, you know, practical methods from the life divine than or from the synthesis. I find that it's much more, I guess I have to really read him much harder to find practical tips from the life divine, but on the other hand, I find it very useful for like setting the lay of the land, so to say.
Yeah, no doubt. The primary goal or objective in the life divine is to give us the map of the terrain and to get our understanding to follow it, to accept it reasonably and logically. Because that orients us. That is the whole idea. The idea is some of what the practical things can be inferred from this, but that inference and kind of clear enunciation is what he does himself in the synthesis of yoga. But over here, if we get this background, it also builds the, you know, armature for the engine of yoga to proceed properly. And also the implications are all there. So sure. That if we really ponder these passages, certain directions start opening up almost unconsciously within us.
Sure. Shall we stop for today and continue next time?
Sure. So our next reading will be on the 27th.
Sure.
Of February.
Yes, and I think we have two darshan days this month, 21st as well as the 29th, mm-hmm. since 2016.
Right. On the 21st, in fact, I'll be in Northern California. And, if some people wish, we could even get together.
Sure, I'll try to put something together for that weekend. I'll speak to you, and based on the availability, I'll send out an email.
Okay, sure.
Okay, thank you, Devashishtha. Let's continue.
You're also starts. Welcome to come to Lodi for Darshan on the 21st.
April Sunday, yeah.
We'll play it by ear. Let's see. It's a possibility. If, I'll be there all of that Sunday. I'm leaving early on Monday.
Okay.
So let's play it by ear. If it works out, then that's also a possibility.
Yeah.
Thank you, Devashish.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, Devashish.